So today we are continuing our study of the Satipatthana Sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya. Many of you have been here since the beginning. If you haven't, we're also trying to record and publish MP3 files of all of the sessions. Last sessions, the MP3 file was corrupted for some reason. The audio was very poor. There was some feedback or distortion. So I was able to edit it a little, but not the best. Hopefully today that will be fixed. So to start, we do the preliminary homage, which is a means of paying respect to the Dhamma, reminding ourselves that what we're about to study is something important, and showing our appreciation for the Buddha and those who have passed on the Buddha's teachings. So we hold our hands up to our chest and recite. Arahang samma sambuddho bhagava buddhang bhagavantang abhivademi svakhato bhagavata dhammo dhammang namasami supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho Sanghang namami. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, so today we start on mindfulness of the body. We have now completed our study of the introduction, and we're moving on to finding an answer to the question, how does one dwell mindful of the body in the body? And so the answer is given in quite a number of sections. And I think it's important to talk about the nature and relationship of these sections to each other. I think I'll give you my take on it all. And I think it's supported by the commentaries and Orthodox Buddhist tradition, is that there are lots of different practices you can undertake. And there's no reason to think that you have to practice each and every one of the meditation techniques in Kaya Nupassana, in the mindfulness of the body, if you want to be considered to be practicing Satipatthana. So when it says in the first paragraph here, it is going to talk about, or the first two paragraphs, we've got the section on mindfulness of breathing. But in the section after that, down below in the section on the Iriyapata. It says Punaccha Parang, and it kind of looks like after you practice mindfulness of breathing, or while you're practicing mindfulness of breathing, and so that you should practice all of these. But this becomes quite difficult when you get down, when you continue on in the list of meditation subjects, and you have the cemetery contemplations and mindfulness of the elements and so on, and you start to wonder how it's possible to practice all of these and what would be the benefit of practicing all of these at the same time. And so it really looks like this discourse of the Buddha is really meant to be a catch-all of all sorts of meditation techniques, rather than being a comprehensive practice that one should try to undertake in full. And I think this is important. It seems obvious, really, but important, because people will often look at this sutta and say, see, everyone has to start by practicing anapanasati. Or this is what the Buddha recommended, anapanasati. And it's true that he did very often recommend anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing. Very often. It's something that he praised and encouraged in his students. But it's certainly not the only thing that he encouraged in his students, and it's not true that all of the Buddha's students were taught to practice mindfulness of breathing. And so whereas it might be considered one of the core practices, it's not necessary. You don't have to practice mindfulness of breathing to be practicing the Buddha's teaching or to be practicing the Satipatthana. This is, I think, important, because people will say that, as I said, people say you have to practice anapanasati, or you have to do this, you have to do that, and the Buddha taught one specific way, or this is the best way, or that is the best way. And it's easy to become narrow-minded and dogmatic about the Buddha's teaching, and lose sight of what's really important. And so this is the other thing I would say about this list of teachings, list of practices, especially in Kaya Nupassana, in mindfulness of the body, is that all of the different sections should be seen really as means of getting at the core, which is mindfulness of the body, which we already discussed in the introduction, or we already mentioned, you know, being mindful of the body and what it means to be mindful of the body. Atapi sampajano satima. What you need are just atapi sampajano satima. And if you're mindful of the body with these three factors, and your vinaya loke abhijja domanasang, if you're giving up desire and aversion, then you're practicing Satipatthana. When you have these three factors and are practicing to give up these two things, regardless of what you're practicing. And I think this is missed in many cases, that teachers or students will miss this and will think, yes, mindfulness of the body should be anapanasati, or it should be this practice or that practice, or that the Buddha's teaching should be, the practice of Buddhism has to be in this format or that format. And one of the reasons why this is so important is because of what we're going to read in this first paragraph. And it's a cause for a great amount of confusion, misunderstanding, and dogmatism. And I'll explain why here. If you look at this paragraph, we see Katancha Bhikkhave Bhikkhu, so he asks, how does a bhikkhu live contemplating the body in the body? And so here we have something actually in the first sentence here that is specific. I'd like to point out this word idha, because it's an important word, and it shows up often. It's how the way that the Buddha talked. The Buddha didn't often use the words "this is the way" kind of thing, or "one must do it in this way." He used the word "ida." I mean, here. And the commentary says it means here in this religion. But whatever it means, it's only an example. It's not saying this is the only way to practice mindfulness of the body. Right? Or this is the only way to practice anapanasati. Because then he's going to say one goes to the forest or goes to the root of the tree or goes to an empty dwelling. And so one thinks, oh, well, if I'm going to be mindful, if I'm going to watch my breath, I have to go to one of these places. I have to find an empty dwelling at the very least, or even better, I have to go to the forest. And you could say, well, an empty dwelling could just be your bedroom or find a room that's empty. But for someone to say that, suppose you can't find an empty room and you have to sit in a room, say, where someone is watching television or so on, and to say, oh, no, you couldn't, that's wrong practice, is the sort of dogmatism that I'm talking about. That's just a simple example. We shouldn't be discouraged because we don't have these sort of resorts. Now, that being said, it's one of the reasons why we often promote the practice of basic tranquility and insight, of not trying to gain mastery of the jhanas or mastery of different meditation subjects. We teach people to gain focus and understanding of the reality in front of them. To start with that, which is considered bare insight, in the sense of not first tranquilizing the mind and using that as a base. Because many people aren't able to find the resort that is necessary for that. As the commentary says, if you don't have one of these places, it's going to be very difficult to develop tranquility. And because most people associate tranquility with meditation, they therefore feel discouraged and think that it's not possible for them to practice meditation. As we'll see at the end of this section and at the end of every section, they shouldn't feel like this, because the Buddha makes it clear that actually mindfulness of the body can be practiced in any way, as long as the object is the body and the qualities of mind are there, of atapi sampajano satima, which we talked about last session. Okay, so if you're going to practice, see, the thing about this whole paragraph is that it's making the assumption of the practice of samatha meditation. This is describing the full and a complete path where one develops powerful states of concentration first and then directs one's attention back towards the body. And that's why it's necessary to go to the forest or the foot of a tree or an empty dwelling. And it gets worse, actually, for most of us. Because the next one, palankang abujitwa, means bends his legs crosswise on his lap. And that's really what it does mean. The commentary explains exactly. It means sitting in the full lotus position. So if someone were to say this is the way everyone has to practice meditation, then we've got a real problem, because lots of us can't sit in full lotus. I've done full lotus for an hour, and I think I could do it as a monk and you know, living in the forest, not being stressed out, but not easy for most people. Impossible for many people. And ridiculously dogmatic. If someone were to say proper Buddhist meditation has to be practiced in the lotus position, then this is a sign that that person doesn't have a grip and an understanding on objective reality, let alone the Buddha's teaching. Because what does reality have to do with the lotus position? What is so special about the lotus position? Well, there is something special about it. It allows for strong concentration. It also allows, and this is even according to pre-Buddhist Indian religion, it allows for clear and smooth observation of the breath. So it allows one to enter into the tranquility jhanas, these intense states of concentration, much easier than if you're to just sit normally or sit on a chair. And this is verifiable. If you want to feel happy and powerful in your meditation, sitting in the lotus position is good. Of course, that's if you can do it. If you can't, you'll just feel very, very unhappy and have very poor concentration because of the pain. But the other thing about the lotus position is that it very much requires tranquility meditation. We often have meditators who come to practice what we teach, which is, you know, the basic contemplation of the body, without entering into the summit, the tranquility jhanas. And they try to practice the lotus position and repeatedly come back reporting intense pain that just doesn't go away. They'll acknowledge it and they can't see the impermanence of it because it's quite permanent, or it seems to be quite permanent. And this makes clear the fact that it's unreasonable to think that anyone could sit in the lotus position without entering into some powerful state of concentration. Because when your mind is unconcentrated and going back and forth from being mindful to being unmindful, and when the hindrances are still present, the body will become stressed and then unstressed and so on, and as a result it'll be quite painful. The only way to do it correctly is if you're actually entering into states of tranquility and calm. And then the next part, ujjung kayang panidaya, which according to the commentary means to have a perfectly straight back. And this is one that has got me time and again, having gone to meditation centers where they force you to sit up straight, you have to have a straight back. Having people criticize, how can you be a teacher if you don't sit up straight? Many times, and people, you know, looking down upon it as though there's something intrinsically wrong with sitting comfortably or sitting naturally. And I stand by and defend the meditator's ability to sit comfortably, or in the sense of not forcing the back to go straight. Because for some people it's quite easy to sit with a straight back, people who have strong backs, no? But for some people it's impossible. People who have back problems, people who have tension and stress and so on. But for them to sit up straight is more of a distraction than anything. But the defense will come in the end of this section, the end of every section, where we'll see that there's no reason to think that you have to be in any specific position. This is the importance of the word ida, which really means here. Like, here's an example. Or bhikkhu, ida bhikkhu, here a monk. It's explaining what a monk can do to practice anapanasati. So, if one wants to practice anapanasati the correct way, and this is the correct way if you're practicing it with a view to attain samatha jhana, attain tranquility first. You should sit up straight, get yourself in a lotus position, and be in a place that is secluded, that has no noise and no distractions and so on. And then we come to the next clause here, parimukhaṃ satting upatthapetva. A section that is actually fairly controversial, because we have this word parimukhaṃ, which it's not exactly controversial, it's hotly debated. And this is because we don't really know what it means. I mean, mukha means mouth or face or door or entrance. It can mean all of those things, and it's used in that way. Pari means around or complete, like parinibbana. But it's being used as an adjective. It can be thought to be used as an adjective for sati, a type of mindfulness. But it can also be thought to be a second object to the verb. So in the sense of having established or having aroused, having established is much better, having established mindfulness. And then the second one is having established mindfulness at the parimukha, or having established mindfulness to be around the mukha, around the mouth. And this is a possible it's a reasonable explanation, and that's where people get the idea that mindfulness of breathing has to be practiced at the nose, because you're watching the feeling of the breath touching the upper lip or somewhere around the mouth, right, or the front of the face. So it could mean that establishes mindfulness at the front of the face. But it's certainly not clear that that is what is meant here, because it doesn't say at the face or at the mouth or so on. It says establishes mindfulness to be parimukha, or it establishes parimukha mindfulness, whatever that means. And parimukha could simply mean in front, or as the foremost important thing. And the reason why this becomes important is because then people will say, mindfulness of breathing has to be practiced at the mouth, has to be practiced at the nose. And indeed, the commentaries are of this general opinion, that the basic method of mindfulness of breathing is at the nose. And it certainly makes sense that that would be the case. If you want to gain tranquility, if you want to attain calm, then you focus on the breath going in and going out, this subtle feeling that calms the mind and allows you to enter into a tranquil state. But it's a case of dogmatism if you're to say that mindfulness of breathing has to be practiced at the mouth. And this is something that the commentaries are not guilty of. The commentaries have examples of being mindful of the breath as it goes in and the following it. And then they explain how one goes on to be mindful of the body based on the breath, where the breath touches the body or where it affects the body, or how the body creates the breath, what part of the body creates the breath, which would be the stomach, the diaphragm, which contracts and expands. How does the breath come into the body? Well, the diaphragm contracts and expands. And the expansion of the muscles. And so watching these muscles is a form of mindfulness-based meditation, or meditation, mindfulness meditation based on the breath. And this is also where we get this mindfulness of the stomach, where one watches the stomach saying rising and falling, because it's based or it's associated with the breath, and so it can very much be called mindfulness of breathing, but more in the sense of vipassana than samatha. So if we take this, mindfulness of the breathing has to be taken in two senses, in two meanings, two ways. Either you're practicing it to attain tranquility, or you're practicing it to attain insight. If you're practicing it to attain tranquility, if that's your goal, then you have to focus on the concept of the breath. And so you have to find a place that allows you to be aware simply of the idea of the breath going in and going out. Why is that? Because if you're mindful of the physical sensations themselves, they're impermanent, unsatisfying, and uncontrollable. They change, they come and go, and they're not stable. So it's not possible to use them as an object to gain a stable state of mind. The only stable state of mind that you could gain based on them is the lokuttara jhana, the super mundane meditation, where the mind lets go of them, lets go based on the realization that they are indeed impermanent, unsatisfying, and uncontrollable. Once that realization arises, one enters into a stable state of mind, but based on the objects themselves, one can't enter into a stable state of mind, which is why people are often critical and uncomfortable and unwilling to practice mindfulness of the stomach, for example, because it is unpleasant, it is uncontrollable, it's not something that you can find peace or happiness in. And that's the point. The point is that through watching it, the mind becomes disgusted and disenchanted, and inevitably turned off and rejects the object, which is the purpose. That's where one eventually has to come anyway. If one enters into the jhanas through the practice of tranquility, eventually one has to come out and contemplate the body in and of the body. So really, mindfulness of the breath, if you want to be clever about it, mindfulness of the breath is not mindfulness of the body, because the breath is not the body. And the only way the breath could be considered to be the body is if you're talking about not of the breath itself, which is a concept, but if you're talking about the body that shapes and forms the breath. So this is how we should understand mindfulness of breathing as it relates to the breath. If it's going to be actually mindfulness of the body, and this is really the point, that we don't get caught up on any one of these techniques, but we remember what we're trying to do, and that's to see the body and the mind as impermanent, unsatisfying, and uncontrollable. Then we have to remember that the mindfulness of breathing is a preliminary exercise that calms the mind and allows one eventually to see clearly in regards to the physical, in regards to the four elements, actually, the ultimate reality of the experience. Because you see, when you talk about breath going in and going out, it's actually just the elements. If it's at the lip, then there's a coolness or a heat, or else there's a pressure. If you're watching at the stomach, there's the pressure in the stomach. This is the reality of the experience. The truth is that the breath is not really, doesn't really exist. So if you wanted to be simple and stick to what the goal is, and that is the mindfulness of the body, then you could read the next sentence, which is so satova asasati, satova basasati, and say, well, just be mindful of the physical breathing in and breathing out. When you breathe in long, just know that you're breathing in long. When you breathe out long, you know you're breathing out long. When breathing in short, breathing out short, and so on. Just be aware of it. The meaning is be aware of it however it occurs. Don't try to force it. In the beginning, anyway. The implication here, and according to the commentary, it's what is meant, is that actually you are trying to smooth and calm the breath. And if you read in the Visuddhimagga, it goes into great detail about how to how one goes about doing this by eventually just being aware, just counting, like now the breath is going out, now the breath is going in, without actually following it or actually using the breath as the object, just getting focused on this idea that the breath is going out, the idea that the breath is going in. And the Visuddhimagga talks about how the person watching the cows doesn't have to go around counting the cows. They just, as the cows go through the gate, they count them 1, 2, 3, and then they don't have to follow after the cows. In the same way, one just sits at the nose, puts one's attention at the nose, and when the breath goes out, one knows that the breath is going out. When the breath goes in, one knows that the breath is going in. So not really being mindful of the breath at all, just having this concept that the breath is going in, that the breath is going out, which calms the mind. And before I get on with that, I want to go back again to this Parimukhang Satting Upatapetu. I missed something there, and that's the translation here. Because actually the translator, I think this is Bhikkhu Bodhi, isn't it? I can't remember whose translation we're following. This is by Soma Thera. It's an interesting translation of Parimukhang Satting, because he says the breath is in front, and that's, he's mindful of the, he establishes mindfulness on that which is in front, but it's really, really an odd translation, because there's nothing in the grammar that suggests that it's referring to the breath being the parimukha. So I just wanted to mention that I wouldn't go with this translation. I would go with either one of the translations that I mentioned, which are pretty standard, and that's the debate about which one it means. Does it mean establishing mindfulness at the fore, or in, you know, as the most important, or does it mean establishing mindfulness around the mouth? So I would think it's got to be either one or the other. Okay, so when you're practicing mindfulness of breathing, and I would direct people, if they're really interested in mindfulness of the breathing in detail, to the Visuddhimagga, which goes into some detail about how one practices this. Being mindful of the in-breaths and out, the long breaths and the short breaths, and then tranquilizing the body. There's another one, Sabbakaya Patisamvedi Asasisami. This whole idea of Sabbakaya is, I think, hotly debated as well. Again, I don't teach this sort of thing, so I'm not, it's not really something that that I pay much attention to, but as I understand, the idea is that Sabbakaya is actually referring to the breath body. Means being aware of the entire breath from the beginning to the end, and that's one interpretation. But you could, and other people, I think the commentaries say that it's referring to tranquility of the mind, of the consciousness, and so on. Actually, the Anapanasati goes into more detail here, but it could just mean calming the body, right? It could just mean that eventually the stilling the body so that there is only the breath. When the mind when the body becomes still, and one trains oneself to have the only movement be the breath, and have the breath be perfectly tuned so that it's exactly regular, you know? Oh, sorry, experiencing the whole body and then calming the activity of the body. So the first one is breathes by experiencing the whole body. So with that one, it means experiencing the entire breath as it goes in and out. Or it means being aware of one's entire body as the breath goes. But it's the second one is the pasambayangkaya sankara, where it calms the activity of the body. The point being that the word kaya is often interpreted to mean the breath body, or else it's the tranquility of mind versus tranquility of the mental concomitants or something like that. The point being that one enters into a stillness, and the assumption here is that after that one enters into the jhanas. And the commentary goes on and explains how that is, that this is the path for one who is attempting to enter into the jhanas. But it certainly doesn't have to be that way. And I know that there are traditions that encourage people to practice this tranquility before going on to vipassana. In fact, really, in our tradition, this is how it occurs as well. When a person even is watching the stomach, the first breakthrough that they have is this tranquility. Eventually their mind is able to let go and allow the breath to move in its natural rhythm, and one enters into great states of peace and calm without entering the jhanas, the samatha jhanas per se, what would be understood by other teachers to be the jhanas. One is still, you know, fighting with the hindrances on and off, but finds oneself in a place where there are no hindrances, where one is able to be aware of the breathing, the rising, the falling without hindrances for some time. And so this is really, in a sense, it is the first stage of meditation, that before gaining any real insight, one will just simply attain calm and the mind will become peaceful. And this is where we talk to the meditators about the vipassana upakilesa, these things that are actually a danger. Yeah, they're in and of themselves are not dangerous at all, but present a danger to the meditator who is unfamiliar with them and who may get caught up and lost in them and think that they are the goal and become attached to them and waste time and effort and even get off track and get caught up in delusion and in some rare cases drive themselves crazy because they're living in a world of illusion, without being able to let go and see that these states of peace and calm are conditioned, are unsatisfying, are uncontrollable, are impermanent. Okay, so this is a description of the beginning of the meditation practice. One might say that this is put at the beginning to encourage people to start here and work until their mind becomes calm and then begin to practice the rest of the sections. Which, for some of the other sections, it makes sense. It makes sense that one would begin with a simple exercise as an example. And I think this is really how we should understand things, teachings like this. The Buddha is not trying to say that everyone has to sit down and watch the breath in order to become enlightened. But this is a good way to begin to learn about reality. Because to encourage someone, if we put the second section at the beginning, for example, and encourage people to start by being mindful of the various movements of the body, standing, walking, sitting, lying down, and all of the other positions that might arise, then it becomes quite difficult and confusing for the meditator who doesn't even know what is the body and what is the mind. But if you start them off with a single object, which is the breath, and then have them use that as an example and expand that to begin to be mindful of other objects, then it becomes much easier for the meditator to understand and extrapolate upon, which is exactly how we will teach it in our traditions. Begin with mindfulness. Just have them do ordinary meditation, both walking and sitting, but don't teach them about how to be mindful in other positions or in other ways until they're able to cope with this first exercise. Once they've done it for practiced it for several hours, then we start to explain to them how to be mindful of other objects, which is exactly how you see it in the sutta, so I think it's a valid method. Okay, so the beginning is this tranquility, whether it's talking about the jhanas or simply talking about stabilizing your mind to the point where you're able to be aware of one object at a time. And then he gives a simile, which, it's just saying, just as a skilled person in any craft becomes aware of the activities of their craft. And the real pointer, I would say, is to stress how important it is to get good at it, at the technique. So once you're good at the technique of meditation, for example, when we watch the stomach rising and falling, then you begin to apply it in other ways. So the first task for a meditator isn't to meditate. The first task for a meditator is to become skilled in the practice of meditation. Because a beginner meditator won't really be meditating. They'll be doing everything wrong. They'll be forcing, they'll be controlling, they'll be thinking, they'll be wandering, until they get good at it. And once they become skilled at it, as skilled as this turner, which is, I can't remember what a turner is, someone who works a lathe, I think. Someone who carves, who smooths wood, something like that. Can't remember what a turner is, but the point is anyone in any craft, when they get skilled at it, then they can see these things. And the point is to encourage or stress that one has to become, or the point is to get good at it. One has to practice and shouldn't be discouraged how in the beginning it's difficult. One should practice until one is skilled at being aware of the breath and staying with the breath. And that's the point, I would say, of that paragraph. The next paragraph is what we're going to see. This is what I mentioned already. It's one of the most important paragraphs in the sutta as far as explaining what is mindfulness. And it's one that I refer back to often. The other one was in the introduction, where the Buddha talks about ātāpi sampajāno satimā vinaya loke abhijja domana saṅgha. That's one also that we always refer back to explain what we mean by mindfulness. But this next paragraph, where we have, which starts iti ajatang wa kaya kayanupasi viharati, gives the second half of the equation. It gives the second part of our description of what we mean by mindfulness of the body, or what we mean by mindfulness at all. And the first part is a little bit odd, and it's something that I still don't quite... I mean, I understand what is being said, but it's a little bit odd. I'll explain how it is. One contemplates the body internally or contemplates the body externally, basically, is what it's saying. Or both internally and externally. And the commentary says that this means one's own body or another person's body. And this does make sense, but I would say it makes the most sense if it's understood thus, that this paragraph, as we can see, is repeated for every section, but some of the sections only apply to an external body. For example, the cemetery contemplations. I think maybe they're the only example, but in the cemetery contemplations, one is mindful of the body externally, meaning mindful of another person's body, and uses another person's body to reflect back on one's own body internally as being subject to all of that as well. And this leads to calm, and it can lead to insight as well, as one looks at the objects of reality and sees that indeed they are not permanent, they are not self, because they can't be controlled and they don't belong to us and we don't take them with us. And we can't stop them from falling apart and fading away. But I think that's really the best way to understand this, because otherwise the idea is being aware of someone else's breath as a meditation object, which doesn't make much sense to me. So I would say I'm not trying to take a stand as to what it means, but I would express my confusion if one were to suggest that a valid meditation practice would be being mindful of someone else's breath. But there certainly are mindfulness of practices of the body that are external. So we can think of this stock paragraph at the end as just the comprehensive statement of different ways in which one can be mindful, where it may not necessarily refer to actually being mindful of someone else's breath, but thus he is mindful of the body in the body, and mindfulness of the body in the body can be internal, external, or both internal and external, meaning going back and forth. But I would say in this case it's probably very much internal. The other way you could understand this, I can't remember if this is anywhere validated or expressed, is because there are the internal and the external senses. So the breath could be considered internal as far as it touches the body, and the body can be understood as internal. So where the breath touches the lip, for example, and heat is created, there is both the internal and the external. So one can be aware of the pressure that is touching the lip, or one can be aware of the lip which receives the pressure, and therefore in that way aware of the heat. Or one can be aware of the air in the stomach as being an external thing expanding the stomach, or one can be aware of the stomach which is being expanded by the air as being an internal contemplation. So internal, external could also be referring to the internal and external senses. And of course this is with the body, but with the other senses it works as well. One can be aware of the light, or one can be aware of the eye, or one can be aware of both the light and the eye, or be aware of the simple consciousness or the simple act of seeing. With hearing, one can become aware of the ear, or one can become aware of the sound. And this you'll see elsewhere, where the Buddha talks about the internal and external, because they both exist. There's both the light and the eye, there's both the sound and the ear. And one could go back and forth or be mindful of one or the other. And at different times in one's practice, one will be aware of one or the other. I think that's another valid way of understanding internal and external, though I won't take a stand as to what the Buddha actually meant to. But I think those are both important points to make, that sometimes one is aware of another person's body, and one is aware of the body both internally and externally in terms of that which touches the body and the body which is touched by something external. That's the first part. Then we have probably a more easy to understand concept, although I think the commentary makes it a little more difficult by explaining the samudaya dhamma as being those things that cause the breath, and the vaya dhamma as those things that prevent the breath. Meaning, those things, when absent, cause the absence of the breath. That the breath is dependent on the diaphragm, for example. So one becomes aware of the diaphragm moving. Or one becomes aware of the fact that when the diaphragm doesn't move, there is no breath, for example. And one becomes aware of the fact that when the mind is with the breath, the stomach, for example, then there is knowledge, then there is the breath, the experience of the breath. And when the mind is somewhere else, then there is no experience of the breath. So being mindful of that which causes the breath and which stops the breath when it doesn't exist. Or when something doesn't arise, then there is the non-arising. Which is really the teaching on paticca-samuppada, the dependent origination, that because of this, that arises, and when this doesn't arise, that doesn't arise. But I think equally important, or maybe even more important in the practice of vipassana, is to simply see that everything arises and ceases. And samudaya and vaya can really simply mean knowledge of the arising and ceasing, which is a very important part of vipassana meditation. As we know from the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, that what Anya Kondanya realized when he heard this sutta was yang kinchi samudaya dhammang sabantang nirodha dhammanti. So whatever is of a nature to arise, that is of a nature to cease. Meaning everything that arises ceases. Nothing is permanent. There is no self, no soul, no entity that lasts from one moment to the next. There are simply experiences which are momentary. And this is important because it's this knowledge of impermanence and anicca, dukkha, anatta that allows one to enter into nibbana. It's only through seeing these three things that one can become enlightened. And so really it means watching things arise and cease, and eventually coming to see that everything arises and ceases. This is the most important part of mindfulness meditation, is the ability of the meditator through practice and through development to see things arise and cease, to see that they aren't lasting, they aren't permanent, they aren't here all the time waiting for us to be mindful of them, waiting for us to be aware of them. They arise and they cease with the awareness. So one can be mindful of the arising, or mindful of the disappearing, dissolution, or one can be mindful of both the arising and the dissolution. And this occurs at various stages of meditation. For example, in Udayabhaya Jnana, the first Vipassana Jnana, one is generally aware of both the arising and the ceasing. But then in Bhanka Jnana, the next stage of knowledge, one naturally becomes focused more on the cessation as being the important point. So once not, the mind isn't so much interested or aware even of the arising, because it's focusing on the fact that everything ceases, and seeing again and again that everything ceases, and coming to see the danger in this and the ramifications of this, that therefore these things are not pleasant and not satisfying, and can't bring lasting peace and happiness. And then we come to one of my favorite parts of the whole sutta, is where he just says, or indeed one, his mindfulness is established with the thought the body exists to the extent necessary just for knowledge and remembrance. And this is what I was talking about, the validation of this idea that you can really be mindful anywhere. I mean, the Buddha comes, when he says, when it comes down to it, atikayoti wa panasa satipachupatita hoti, mindful of the body, mindful that this is body, atikayo, knowing that the body exists, this is body. Or there is the body, and this awareness that the body is, and then the next part is to the extent necessary, just for knowledge and remembrance. Meaning, the whole point of it is to just be aware that, yes, this is happening. It's occurring as it's occurring. It is what it is. This is this. It's not me, it's not mine, it's not good, it's not bad. It has no purpose, it has no intrinsic meaning or value, it just is what it is. It doesn't mean anything more than that, it isn't anything more than that. It is what it is, and that's it. And that's the... I mean, it sounds simple, and it sounds like, well, then you don't have to meditate, you just have to sit and see it for what it is. But the point is, we have a very difficult time doing this. Without meditating, we're unable to do this. From moment to moment in our lives, and even sitting here, you can see that we extrapolate on everything. Rather than just being aware that this is the body, or the body exists, or knowing it as body, or knowing it for what it is, we extrapolate on it. We do say, me, mine, and we worry about it, and we concern about it, and we want, and we like, and we dislike. And we create all sorts of stress and suffering for ourselves. Because we're not able to be aware of things simply as they are without extrapolating. And so this is actually quite an important passage. To just be aware of something just for what it is. And I want to highlight the Pali for this reason. And I'm going to try to pick it apart, so that you can see exactly what the Buddha is saying here. And I can't comment on it because something's wrong with the page, but let's see if I can highlight it here, then I'll highlight it. Otherwise, Yava Deva. Yava Deva Jnana Mataya Pati Sati Mataya, which is just this passage. So Yava Deva, Yava Deva just means just to the extent. Jnanamataya means for mere. Mata means, in this sense, mere knowledge, or you might say bare knowledge. Translated as merely for knowledge. Or bare knowledge, let's say, because jnana is knowledge, knowledge. Matta means merely or barely or simply. And then this next word, which is I think it's a really good word to explain exactly what is meant here by sati. Because, you see, I think I mentioned it before, the word sati can mean many different things in different contexts. Sati can mean memory, so it can refer to your ability to remember things. If you want to develop mindfulness, try remembering things. Remember reciting texts and so on, and translating from one language to another, remembering what this means and what that means. But here we have a word to explain what the Buddha meant, what sort of mindfulness, what sort of sati he was talking about. Equals, so pati sati mataya means pati. Pati means specifically. Sati means remembering And then for bear, yeah. So it means for mere and specific remembrance. It's an important word. It's not easy to translate it if you break it up like that. But I wanted to break it up to show you what the connotation of the prefix and the suffix are. That here we have the word sati in context. We're talking about a remembrance specifically of the bare nature or the simple nature of for example, the body or some part of the body as this is it. It is this. And I think this is an indication of why we use this mantra that we use to remind us of this. The word sati means to remember or to have remembrance of something. But here, the point is to have remembrance of something just and specifically for what it is. So when the stomach rises, to know that it's simply rising. And we're going to see this in the next ones. When walking, to know that we're just walking. When sitting, to know that this is sitting. When there's a painful feeling, to know this is a painful feeling. To know it as it is, it's a painful feeling. It's nothing more, nothing less. And so in order to create this remembrance, this mindfulness in a sense, we have a word. We have a tool, which is the tool of meditation. It's the practice of meditation. So we meditate on it as being simply what it is, reminding ourselves it's pain or it's rising or so on. I think this is actually a quite important passage as well. It's one that I will bring up often to help people understand what is meant by mindfulness and why we use this word, because we're trying to train our minds in a way that the mind is not skilled. People will often wonder why we have to use this artificial or artifice, as you say, why we can't simply be aware of the object, why we can't just be aware of it as we normally would. And the point is that that's in no way considered meditation if you do that. If you're simply being aware of something, then you can't explain how it is that you're changing the mind and how it is that you're training the mind and how it is that you're developing the mind. Because the mind is naturally inclined towards proliferation. If you let the mind simply be aware, then it's going to simply be aware in the way that it always has, and it's going to develop views and ideas and opinions. It's not going to change in any significant way. If anything, it's simply going to repress the bad states of mind without understanding them and without looking at them and seeing them for what they are. But when you develop this remembrance, you're actually changing your mind. You're opening your mind up and you're clearing your mind up. And you'll see that the mind actually begins to accept and let go of all of the problems and difficulties and stresses and negative states that exist inside. And as a result of that, one begins to live anicito, not clinging to anything. Anicito means independent. Means not depending on anything. Very powerful statement. Anicito jo viharati. Why does one dwell independent? Because one is aware of things simply for what they are. Patisatimatta. One is aware of these things just enough to know it for what it is. When one sees, first there is the seeing, then there is the awareness, this is seeing. That was seeing. What just arose was seeing. It wasn't me, it wasn't mine, There doesn't arise the thought, this is me, this is mine, this is good, this is bad, and so on. And therefore, one is independent. One has no dependence on anything. One doesn't require anything. One's happiness and well-being is not dependent on the attainment of the objects of one's desire. One isn't affected by the objects of the sense. One isn't affected by the body in this case. And the second part, nacca kinci loke upadiyati, because one doesn't cling to anything in the world. And here the word world, we've talked about this before, actually means sankhara loka. It's referring to the body itself, referring to experience. One doesn't cling to any experience. One is simply aware of experience, in this case experience of the body, for what it is. When the body is experienced, one is aware of it for what it is and doesn't cling to it, doesn't think of it as good or bad or me or mine. One is simply aware of it, patisatimata, specifically for what it is. And so this is another way, and here we see how this is simply an example. The Buddha says, evampi ko bhikkhu vibhikkhu kaye kayanupassi viharati. The word pi means and or also. So we have this evampi. The pi means this too is a way in which one is mindful of the body in the body. And so that's the section on mindfulness of breathing. And I think that's enough for today, no? We've gotten quite far. Two more paragraphs, didn't we get? Two more Pali paragraphs, which are fairly big paragraphs. So I think we'll end it there for today. So we have something more for tomorrow, for next week. And at this rate, we will be. We have quite many weeks in this important sutta. This is really the core. No, as you can see, this is very much an explanation of meditation practice in a Buddhist sense. So I think it's something that we should take time and go over in some detail. If anyone has any questions, now I'm happy to take them. Otherwise, we can just do the closing homage and call it a night, or a day, or a morning, wherever you are. Does anyone have any questions or comments? Okay, well, if you're still thinking of them or getting ready to ask them, in the meantime, we can do our closing homage. So we go back up to the top where it says preliminary homage, and we're going to do it all except for the last part. Arahang Samma Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivadin. Svākāto bhagavata dhammo dhammang namasam. Supatipanno bhagavato sāvaka sangho sanghang namam. Okay, thank you all for coming. Again, if there are any questions, I'm still here for a few minutes. Otherwise, if all goes well, we'll see you back here next week at the same time, or perhaps tomorrow at our radio session. I don't know what we'll be doing tomorrow because Nagasena is gone, but Palanyani is still here. Nagasena has gone up the mountain to Ratnapura. So I guess we'll just have it with the two of us. Thanks for coming, everyone.